are now listening to New Models. Nobody knows what it actually is.
It's like air or water.
Only the more you drink, the thirstier you get.
Wherever it came from, it don't belong here.
Is it us or is it something else?
It's content today with Carly Busta and Lil Internet.
Anywhere else.
Okay, welcome to my hoarse and sick voice.
Wow, Carly, you sound amazing.
Yes, thank you. I suffered a sore throat for 3 days for it, so let's put it to use.
I feel like the 2026 is just beginning because we've been nonstop with thing after thing after thing.
No kidding, it's been insane.
What have we done?
I mean, when...
So Venice, we've checked in after Venice.
We checked in after Venice. After that, we did a slew of recordings, only one of which we've released. Trevor Paglen was in town for a book launch, which was fabulous at Sybil in Berlin.
We hosted the book launch.
Exactly.
It was a New Models event.
It was a New Models event, video to come. We also recorded with Trevor. Then a few days later, you gave a talk in Berlin with Spike Magazine, giving like an artist talk.
Yes, my first artist talk. About my lifelong relationship with the internet. Very anxiety-provoking experience. I think I said it was like tomb raiding while you're still alive, like kind of digging
the excavation
online.
Process.
Yes, exactly.
Furthermore, your mom and dad were in town. Your brother was
in town.
It was his birthday. It was our daughter Coco's third birthday. We went to Sweden to visit your second cousins. And we just got back. And we have all these ideas, but there's been one thing that's just been nagging us.
We have tons of interviews.
We have tons of interviews that we're going to be releasing.
We're going to be releasing. And
like
the video of the Trevor Paglen event. But there's like this one site of content activity that has just persisted. And so we thought, while we're editing this other stuff, to check in with a content today about...
Taste.
Yeah.
Taste.
Again, fashionably late.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Matt Dryhurst, a couple years ago, when we were working on the All Media is Training Data book, kept saying this refrain of like, taste will be something that you subscribe to. You'll subscribe to somebody's taste on Spotify. Taste will be monetized. It was a really interesting provocation. Like, everybody who works in the culture sector has a kind of pronounced, expressed taste. And then I would see it in tech discourse, taste, taste, taste. And then a bunch of people started writing think pieces on it. There's the AI guy, Paul Graham. There's Kyle Chaka in The New Yorker who wrote Why Tech Bros Are Now Obsessed with Taste. Emily Siegel wrote a really brilliant piece called Taste Slop for Nemesis in May. And then it's just generally been trending on Twitter. But the thing is that the way taste is used, especially on X, it's just like this kind of like alien formation of the word. I mean, I think Emily gets it right. I felt like Kyle Chaka got it right. But I do understand. I'm interested in the way that it's being used on Twitter. And so we want to talk a little bit about what this nebulous concept of taste is or has become.
Yeah, because I think the thing is, and what people haven't addressed, is like going one order up, examining why this conversation is even happening. There's, of course, this one element of it where taste is like this very elastic, shifting, fuzzy word, which makes it perfect for discussion on social media platforms, on X, because taste ultimately describes something ineffable. People talk about taste in general, but then they kind of mean good taste, but then there's also bad taste.
Kind of good taste, right. We're talking about. I mean, in some ways, the word taste works a little bit like Trevor Paglen's Palladium, where when it's used, everybody thinks of the word maybe slightly differently.
Right. Taste has always been about an ineffability. Like, that's how it's been theorized and discussed for hundreds of years. And kind of like vibes or something, right?
Well, that's,
and again, it's like this thing of online, you like take a word that points to something ineffable and like try to fit it into language or some deterministic framework, and it just doesn't work. So you can kind of do it forever, right? Well, debate it forever. I mean, it shows how much, I think it's interesting, shows how language can only kind of gesture at things that feel much bigger than language can capture. And I think LLMs and AI high-pilled guys sometimes don't realize that still, right? It's like they think ineffability is just something woo-woo.
But I do want to talk today. So I'm trying to think about how to structure this. Like, I guess there's this initial idea of the way that taste is used in these tech circles. And it's a very parochial idea of what taste is. It's something that is like a Dieter Rohm style, minimalist, good design. I saw where Paul Graham, he likened it to a beautiful mathematical equation that is reduced to its simplest elements. And there is like a history of taste being related to restraint and that being a kind of good taste. But that's actually more this idea of a bourgeois norm. And being tasteful is normy. I mean, being tasteful right. is not boundary pushing. It's like following a script. That can be automated.
Right. It's like every brand logo just became the name in Helvetica right. because of this like convergence on mass, mid, normy tastefulness. Right.
Right.
But
right.
I think there's something like really weird about this conversation even happening and the way especially the tech guys started talking about it. And I mean, we see it with other things, that Shalom's JPEG thing. I don't know if we want to talk about that.
Do you want to just use that as an anchoring example? Because okay. maybe that sets the...
So ultimately, there's some kind of like somatic atrophy that's happening among a particular tech class and many of them extremely powerful. Another term I played with is like sim swapping.
What does that
like
mean?
Sim swapping is this exploit where you call up T-Mobile and pretend you're someone else and that you lost your SIM card and you need them to beam you a new SIM card immediately because it's an emergency. And then basically you get your target SIM card on your phone and you can download all their apps and steal all their crypto, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm using SIM swap as meaning like the ontology of a simulated environment has been swapped out for their umwelt of the physical material world.
Right.
And it leads to really fundamental blindness or confusion. Like there was this guy, Shloms, who's like this crypto prankster artist. And a couple of months ago, he did this thing that went super viral where he posted an image of a real Monet water lilies painting, claimed it was AI generated, and asked people to say why it was inferior to a real Monet. Uh-huh. And all these people said all these things, tried to articulate why it was inferior. Of course, the image was actually of a real Monet painting. And everyone acted like it was this big gotcha moment where it's like, oh, look, it's all arbitrary. People can't tell the difference between a Monet and an AI generated image.
Like compressed JPEGification.
But an image of a Monet right. is not a Monet.
Right, exactly.
Like, and I see a lot of yeah. conversations about art on Twitter, especially where people confuse the images of art, JPEGs of art for the art. And it's crazy to me. Like there's this total discounting of the somatic feeling, the embodied feeling of being in front of an actual Monet painting and the difference in how that feels than seeing a JPEG of a Monet. It's like those two experiences yeah, like, have just been flattened.
Even the idea that like, I mean, I forget what Monet it was, but presumably it was something.
It was a random water lilies.
Right, right, right. Like, it wasn't like one of his iconic Monet, ones, yeah. right? When he's like losing his vision, yes. probably. And the default used to be when you saw a piece of art or even a reproduction of a piece of art was this is a work by this person who lived during this time in this context, and they are using this medium of, let's say, painting in Monet's case, to communicate something, to distill a moment or a feeling or a thought or a provocation or whatever in this painting. And your job as the viewer was to stand in front of that painting or the reproduction of it and try to unpack it, like in good faith, try to understand what was going on using your knowledge of the artist's biography and their location and the circle of friends that they would have been making this for and try to decode it. That was the exchange. It wasn't just like random piece of visual stimuli dropped in front of your face. You have a reaction to it. Like it's right. just beside the point to try to compare. Like if Monet had AI I and Monet made a P. You know, it like it's just so stupid. It's like right. it doesn't that that's like
well,
that's
people
like a false,
can't tell the difference between a JPEG of a Monet and a generated JPEG
I mean,
of a Monet.
They're trying to do like a Turing test type thing. They're trying to like use that formula on art, but it just doesn't. I mean, a Turing test is a very interesting principle, but when it comes to art and AI generated images, it's just beside the point. Let's like right. not you engage with a piece of art. Like what makes something good or not good? I mean, like Otto Mueller, like painted in shit. Like that's such a subjective, historically dependent thing.
But the difference is that when you stand in front of a Monet painting, like even let's put it in like computer guy terms, it's like the data of the full physical painting being there,
right.
like your mind decompresses that into a whole historical imaginary, like a tactile, you can kind of feel the time it came from in a way you can't looking at a JPEG.
Right.
You can imagine like a context and a place and a situated point in history in a way you cannot looking at the JPEG of that
right,
painting.
Right, right.
And the fact that there's a total seemingly like blindness or blank spot about that difference.
Indifference is to that.
Really, right. really crazy. And I think a similar thing is happening with taste, right? Like the word itself, taste, it emerged out of taste like tasting food,
uh-huh.
right? Like the German word, right?
Oh, tasten, but that's like a sense.
To feel the yeah, sense with the body, feel, yeah. right? So taste always referred to a somatic experience,
right.
something you like feel and intuit and feel in your body when you encounter it, right?
right.
And there, again, thinking of taste as something that's like codified and reduced based on like a visual aesthetic pack or something.
Right.
right?
I mean, and but the thing is again, there's a slippage. So like taste and tasteful, like
right.
what is tasteful to the mid is calculable. That is something
right.
that like, you know, is generatable. But is that actually like cool or interesting or stylish or edgy or provocative? Or no, none of the above. It's tasteful in the way that a sorority girl puts on a Lily Pulitzer dress and like some hoop earrings or whatever and is like, I have taste. It's like a very narrow idea of what taste is
right.
that has been socially validated by tech circles.
Also, it's monolithic the way they're
yeah.
treating it or imagining it as if taste is a monolith and not like context dependent.
Right. There's
always
also
shifting.
This idea that it's inherently monetizable. Like I'm going to skin my whatever tech product with this aesthetic, and therefore it's going to be a successful aesthetic because it has quote unquote taste. Or it's like when you walk into a co-working space, there's just like all these dumbass things like neon signs like of empowerment.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, it's been a while since I've been in a co-working space like that. Or like third wave coffee aesthetics. Like there's an aesthetic that they imagine to be tasteful, which is just really mid, but it's skinned that way. They can charge it a little bit more. It seems like it's signaling maybe like something quiet luxury. It's like taste in this generic sense of what's tasteful to the mid, let's just say millennial in 2026.
Right. There's a difference between good taste and exquisite taste and impeccable taste and excellent taste.
But also like American like, taste or European taste
right.
or like, I don't know.
Like all like, of those things actually feel different, right?
Yeah.
So when people are talking about like taste, I almost like don't know exactly what they mean.
Like, yeah, but we do. Like in the
tech
space,
right.
that's exactly what they mean. They mean tasteful. They mean like
they mean
mid,
tasteful.
Mediocre, tasteful. That's
right.
what they mean in a particular 2026 framework.
And yeah. then, but like tasteful, like, yeah, compared to what? It's
right. It's not an on or off. It's not like, do you have, everyone has taste. Like that's
right.
the thing.
That's
it's like, but that slippage has produced this like interesting miscommunication in the ex-Twitter space.
Yes.
That's, yeah, that's kind of mind-boggling because when you're reading these tweets, you just feel like they're missing something. I mean, I actually want to shout out Emily Siegel. I just, like, searched taste. So obviously my network will come up first. But there's
well, she
this,
had the big, I mean, that
she
was a viral
the taste lop
piece. Yeah.
Yes, exactly, in May, which was great. But so there's somebody who's starting something called Taste Labs. And to quote, our mission is to end AI slop. We're building the data and infrastructure layer to give AI models and agents taste, right? And Emily's retort, which I thought was so good, is just when taste is fully automated, it ceases to function as taste, right?
I mean, also some things will never be tasteful by their nature, too.
I mean, that
and
said,
so,
like a lot of the defense tech corporations are doing some like extremely quote-unquote tasteful advertising,
right?
Work-life what is it? Work-life peace balance, for instance.
Yes, work-life peace balance is the one. Berlin, by the way, we get back from Stockholm and like every ad in the airport is suddenly...
What used to be like a BMW ad or like an Audi ad is now drones.
Because Germany, their car companies are getting like slaughtered. Like down, profits down like 40% or something because BYD, which Americans don't have, but Chinese BYD electric cars are just devouring the market. And so German industry is now all pivoting to defense tech. And you actually see that around the city with the advertising.
I mean, there was an aviation conference here in June, so I think that there was probably a heightened amount. But interestingly...
Yeah, but right by our apartment, there's a giant billboard for defense tech hiring.
Well, also, I mean, aviation could mean private jets. So the fact that now it's really consolidated around this idea of, like, specifically, like, defense aviation is also significant. But yeah, a billboard... Yeah, what?
My theory is that Berlin's known for its like crazy nightlife and queer scene. And, right. But my theory is that they situate defense tech industry in Berlin because they're like, oh, you want to know what we're fighting to protect? You want to know what freedom really is? Like, this is what we fight for. And they take them to Bergheim or laboratory and it's like a piss orgy. And they're like, we only have the freedom to have piss orgies because we defend our territorial sovereignty. This is what we fight for.
Work-life balance.
This is the freedom that we need to protect, right? So I think that's how it works.
I mean, I just posted a bunch of snapshots in the Discord and I just said, like, who is this for? Like, the pedestrian level consumer, like, why do they need this? And Jay Springett nailed it. He's like, well, it's just like predictive conditioning. Mm. It's like, get used to the idea of defense as this positive thing again. Is this, you know, just for context, wearing fatigues in Berlin until a few years ago was like not okay. Like, there was such a aversion
to... Why didn't you tell me?
I mean, to be a soldier wearing fatigues or something was really not okay. You know, Berlin used to be the place where if you wanted to avoid compulsory military service, you had an option to move to Berlin, which needed young people because it was isolated in East Germany. It was this pocket of West Germany.
It still to this day does not have the population that it had at its greatest, which is like before World War II
that's
or something.
True.
It still doesn't have...
I think that's true. But in any case, you can move here and you can do community service instead of doing military service. And so there's always been a pacifist tone to Berlin. So seeing all these defense billboards in residential areas of Berlin is unnerving. I mean, and they are very, quote, tasteful. It's not like a Trumpian MAGA style meme slop kind of aesthetic. It's very sans serif, blurred images of defense in fog. I mean, it looks like it could be like a Autechre album cover or something. Sorry, Autechre. I mean, it really is like playing into some kind of like techno.
Yeah, it's leading into like the dark, cold. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. This must be idiosyncratic and just me, but there is something about it that like recontextualizes the club where you're in these hard, cold industrial spaces listening to techno and then the defense tech industry is like, it was like before it was some kind of like cathartic LARP or something engage with this like dark industrial technological mode. And now it almost feels
like...
like
men like half naked in technical gear and you're like, is this war?
Yeah, right, exactly. It feels like there's like a resonance between like the jouissance of war and the jouissance of the club or something.
Right. Yeah, totally.
So I think like a new vibe has been unlocked in Berlin through this coexistence of now defense tech and like hedonistic dark clubbing, right?
And it's like, you know, from an economic point of view, it's like literally necessary for the perpetuation of the socialist state. Like, if they want social security, if they want to continue this generous social democratic structure, they feel like amping up their defense tech is their best bet. Yeah, that's probably for another podcast. Also, like co-locating energy resources and AI data centers. But
yes, it is very, very weird that this taste conversation even happened in the first place to me.
Yeah.
Like, it reflects a very kind of disembodied alien logic that you would start a conversation of taste and approach it in this way. Like, only someone who doesn't remember that taste is something somatic would approach it from this way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But I think there's like, I mean, I was chatting with Matt Dreihurst a little bit because He posted something about the Medici's deployed taste and the robber barons deployed taste and Elon Musk deployed taste without having it, and that they were each seen as kind of tacky, but they got away with it because...
Also, they shared it with the public. Right. They saw themselves as stewards of taste.
And I guess you could see the Cybertruck as like an aesthetically adventurous design for a vehicle, and only someone like Elon could push that through. I think that was sort of the argument, but that a lot of tech entrepreneurs just have such parochial scope when it comes to taste, that they're sitting on a lot of resources that could be used towards like a much more interesting cultural sphere, but they're not unlocking those because of some taste preset.
Yeah, I also think like predicting taste, if I think about how that works, it starts to throw me into this like mise en abyme of something, because good taste is oftentimes formulated in reaction to the context of what is happening in the mainstream, right?
Yeah.
So if taste becomes predictive, like, yeah, taste immediately changes.
That's
in response,
right? It can't be predictive, right?
Right.
I mean, an interesting example is normcore. Here, we're going to take an objectively uncool, very mid, not stylish taste preset, and we're going to utilize it to, like, flex against, I don't know, would it be like influencers trying to be independently, individually special or something. It was like this idea of leaning into bad taste in order to reclaim it. Or, you know, think of camp, obviously.
Right.
Like, people have always used style to negotiate changing social hierarchies. Like Andy Warhol being really preppy in the 80s. Like, if you were gay in the 80s, one option was to just be like waspy preppy.
Right.
Because that allowed you to navigate these places. Or think of like Ralph Lauren, nay Lipschitz. The Lauren part, of course, is, you know, an artist name. And like styling this idea of old American taste, right? Or Calvin Klein or Donna Karan. Or there was so much of this like taste production in order to negotiate changing social hierarchies with the industrialization and
right.
the rise of white collar jobs. So we're going through a shift like that again.
I also think it's interesting. I mean, taste cannot really be reduced to like an aesthetic pack, right? I mean, I think about these guys, ESP, I think on year 001 records, like two really young guys who make kind of like ambient trance. But like their style is like, it's like TJ Maxx core, kind of like things you can just, that are always on the racks at like TJ Maxx, but they make it look so cool,
right,
you know?
Right,
and
right,
it's
right.
like the ability to take something that's like poor taste and make it
pop,
look good,
yeah,
feel
right,
tasteful.
Right.
Like that's a real skill, right?
Definitely.
And that's why you can't, it's irreducible, and it depends on the person executing and expressing it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I also noticed that like, there's this wave of like young Zoomer men where their real expression is like just through the body, is so much of it.
It looks maxi.
To be like, well, it's kind of like, but even in alternative, uh-huh. right? Like you look at the guys who do that Genesis party in London,
uh-huh.
right? And they're all like kickboxers, like athletes with perfect bodies who have like really good, cool, futuristic design tastes and do these incredibly produced parties with deconstructed trance and kickboxing.
Mm.
But it's like so much of the expression is just through the body itself.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when I was 20, like working out was uncool. Like,
well, I was just
going
to say, I mean, these like right. ectomorphic indie boys were always really hot. That's like what was coded as hot in the aughts.
Right.
Like skinny, no muscles, hair that had been washed in 2 weeks. That was hot. So it's just like a changing norm. But yeah, when we were in Sweden, it's such a retail culture, or I should just say Stockholm. We were saying also like near the train station, but there's such a high street culture there. I really understood like Drainer taste
right.
in a like kind of a newfound appreciation for it, right? Because that sort of is the yin or yang to this like very normie high street, everything looking kind of.
Yeah, Stockholm is like 50% teenagers walking around retail spaces.
The rest are
middle aged people wearing System of a Down t-shirts.
That's because we were there during this like the first time System of a Down is played in like, I don't know, 10 years in Europe. But yes, that was a great intersection.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I love bringing in the media theory angle, but like taste within a mass public versus taste for a network public versus taste for a completely like algorithmically dispersed like neural public. These are different things, right. I think, right?
Yeah,
like,
I would
taste
say so.
Is something different when you have the fire hose of taste that was Condé Nast. I mean, Anna Wintour did make prospective employees fill out basically like the SATs of Condé. They had to like be able to properly define a certain number of things, sort of put together a taste profile successfully, and they couldn't even be considered for hiring.
Mm.
But yeah, you think of like how that's different than during like Bloghouse or earlier network culture where you were just really thinking about taste in relationship to your scene.
Right.
To now where scenes are constantly mediated by platforms.
Yes.
So like, what is taste? How do you even communicate taste?
I mean, encounters with taste that have any sort of potency at all are still going to happen in actual social environments,
yeah,
and physical environments, right? I mean, I guess the taste discussion on X is they're really all discussing the tasteful arrangements of pixels on a screen or something. I mean,
I think taste starts to get interesting when you think about prediction markets and like that kind of thing. Like, where is the convergence of futarchy and taste? Like,
right.
I mean, already we have this idea.
What's the biggest scale taste can operate?
I don't know, right?
Like what if prediction markets themselves are distasteful because gambling is distasteful?
Yeah, I mean, I wish that would be the case, but you know, it's more like just how we're seeing tasteful public messaging for defense tech as a way of like preconditioning us. I think you could have taste directing prediction markets, which then become a new form of governance. Like, can you govern through taste? Can you find the node of taste that are like just aspirational enough to like convince people? I mean, we've all bought a product before because we thought its packaging was generally tasteful, only to realize the product was actually shit,
right.
Which is like white labeled, right? But like taste can condition people. So again, I think when they're talking about taste, they are talking about a certain kind of aspirational, but like ultimately mid tasteful preset. That's what I think they're doing.
And maybe they're, and it's interesting though that like MAGA, like Trump and the MAGA movement kind of like explicitly deployed a kind of anti-taste, right?
That's true,
in their communication. So
yeah.
Why is the tech industry now suddenly concerned with having good taste?
I mean, there is something that feels distinctly like...
Or does anti-taste get exhausted?
It does. Yeah,
right?
It does. Obviously, it doesn't feel very grown up. And I mean, Palmer Luckey wears like a Hawaiian shirt and is this kind of irreverent gesture. But the messaging of Anderol is, even if it's like...
Palmer Luckey has really bad taste in facial hair.
I know.
I have to say. I'm not going to say it.
Okay. Yeah, the way like surrounds his mouth is like, looks like
landing strip for a horizontal vagina. There, I said it.
Oh my God. Yeah, it does. But you know, we recorded with Simon Denny, so we'll have a whole episode actually on the aesthetics of defense tech coming to you very soon. But there, you know, I guess like defense tech on some level feels like they need to code adult. And so there's a tasteful, responsible, like seriousness that is returning. It's not LOL. It's like,
right. I mean, it's also true that you look at PowerPoints leaked from the Defense Department or something, the one about mass surveillance that Trevor Paglen always cites,
yeah.
You know, but they are the jankiest,
yeah,
ass PowerPoints you've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
There is like a void of taste at the highest echelons of power, right? And I think maybe the tech class are hyper concerned with their public presentation.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I mean, in a way, it's like taste is a way they can humanize themselves more, like
kind of,
I don't know, seem more like peers in the world who have taste just like you, human. Like I
mean, maybe what comes to mind for me is, you know, the Zuckerberg t-shirt. They're all like thinking this casual thing is cool, but now this Helvetica style taste is their suit. That's the thing that they put on their decks, let's say, to seem like they mean business. But there is an interesting shift that happens there, right? Like, they themselves still show up in, like, a Hawaiian shirt with pussy facial hair, but yet their deck means business. So there's, like, I don't know, there's some shift in the personal presentation versus the digital communications that's happening.
Mm.
I mean, I made this old list on an older consulting job we were doing, but I feel like it's relevant here. I just made a quick list of like bad taste and good taste. So bad taste
This was like several years ago,
yeah, this
right?
is several years ago. So bad taste is like network algorithmic provincialism. So like unadventurous navigation is bad taste. Network illiteracy, being mid or striving to be legible as mid. Performative gestures of transparency and or community. So just this like general like professional managerial class talk is bad taste. Socially regressive behavior like consuming loads of fast fashion, demanding single-use plastic, over-reliance on app-based convenience services, carbon-intensive travel, ignorance of supply chain externalities, all of that is bad taste. Refinement to the point of homogenization feels like bad taste. Flexing on the nose signifiers of power, like legacy signifiers of power. I forget what
like
that was in reference to.
Mega yacht or something?
Probably so, right. Subservience to a platform's dynamics or physics is bad taste. Like if you're machine pleasing, yes. That's bad taste. Non-conscious actions or subservient to a limbic system. So like reacting to something, particularly online, like is bad taste. Being stuck in screen space feels like bad taste, like wanting to be an influencer is bad taste. Whereas good taste would be algorithmic cosmopolitanism, like being able to like navigate lots of different kinds of algorithmic spaces, network literacy, creative protocols, the edges of the bell curve, your conscious brain, your neocortex being privileged, getting rid of yourself online or disappearing into the swarm feels like good taste. That's like a long, like from Bernadette Corporation era, you know, get rid of yourself. It still holds true. And your eyes being liberated from the screen feels like good taste. Mm. Like not looking at a screen, but like looking at something IRL feels like good taste. Mm. Like I think one of my issues with this discussion of taste is that it is really based in aesthetics.
Yes.
When like taste is it's never just...
Right. It's like, again, it's like there's these people who... It mostly experience the world through one sense, right?
Right.
Through sight, sometimes sound.
But taste is so much more. I mean,
taste, and the meaning of the word, word points back to somatic sensory experience. Taste like tasting food.
Yeah.
It's all there in the word.
Like your cousin's house in Sweden is like a simple farmhouse and it is like so ridiculously tasteful because
yes.
It is just so comfortable and like simply beautiful. It's like not fancy, although it is so luxurious.
Yes.
Because it's just like fields and flowers and a wood house with good food. And I don't know, it's just like absolutely ideal because of that,
right.
But not because of any kind of external signifiers of taste.
Right.
I mean, there are, of course, subtle signifiers of taste. They have excellent taste, but it's really simple.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and well, if you were trying to like reverse engineer it, you'd be like, oh, taste is putting a 19th century Chinese wedding bed in a Swedish barn. Like that doesn't make sense. And
right.
Other
contexts, they haven't like, had yes. that in
right,
their barn.
Right. Right. And so I think my main reason for wanting to have this conversation, though, is that I think we have to watch out for these super low order bios level faults and blind spots of very influential and powerful class of people.
Right.
Because they seem to misunderstand things that are so fundamental that they almost become invisible.
I mean, I would...
Like the whole base gets shifted if
yes.
you actually point it out. Like the whole base kind of crumbles.
But I would reframe this as... All of you in the culture sector listening, there's a massive opportunity here to teach literacy of taste. I see it like, yes, be maybe wary of people talking about taste in this narrow way, but there's just a big opportunity because like if this tech world can connect with the culture sector that's really innovating all different forms of taste and style, it would be great for everybody. It would be like a true renaissance moment.
That's true.
I think to Matt's point, like when the Medicis funded all of these artists, you got a lot of really cool stuff. Like the renaissance really gets unlocked with the Medicis because they're like, here's a ton of money, go do your thing.
Right.
Right? And they allowed it to happen. And right now there's this recursive thing where like, taste is this black on white or white on black, sans serif typeface, blonde wood, empty room, minimalist tattoo thing. And tattoos, I was just, you know, it's like the particular kind of edginess that's allowed within this spectrum. And then that's what gets made. And it's boring.
Right.
And it's like suffocating. And there's just like a lot more weird stuff that could happen. And like weird is also a kind of bound idea of like, yeah, like the neon sign or the cocktail. Or even like when they try to be edgy in these tech spaces, it often feels a little bit like the Jehovah's Witness convention that was happening at the hotel where we were staying, where like wild and crazy is like somebody wearing crazy glasses. Yeah, I don't know. There's definitely like a very big opportunity here to leverage this taste conversation into like unleashing a lot of people's experimentation.
So as alien as its origins are, they need to be way more philanthropic,
yes,
this class, and please invest heavily in taste and supporting, yes, taste makers.
Yes. The end.
The end. As a helicopter is landing across from us,
right? Military hospital, as
right,
it were.
Right now. Anyway, so, yeah, I think this is, oh, Carly, our helicopter's here. We got to go on,
yes,
our helicopter and go to the Hamptons. Thank you for listening to this brief content today. We'll be back with
Simon Denny or Trevor Paglen,
the video of our event, something, but yeah, more very soon. Thank you.
Ciao.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Content Today. If you just saw this pop up in your podcast feed, there's a few more notes about what we've been up to on Patreon and Substack. We're currently enjoying one miraculously uninterrupted month in Berlin to crack on new models before we head to the US and then Montreal, where we'll speak at MuTech on August 26th. We'll also be speaking at the excellent Indigo Festival in Ljubljana, Slovenia on October 7th. Tickets for both are now on sale. A very long and wild conversation with artist Simon Denny is incoming, as well as video and audio with Trevor Paglen. Shout out to everyone who came to the book launch, as well as to my artist talk with Spike. It was really, really encouraging to see so many of you. Thanks again, stay tuned, and see you next episode.